This is VOA News. By a remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. Dr. Anthony Fauci says the United States is in an unnecessary predicament of soaring COVID-19 cases fueled by unvaccinated Americans and the virulent Delta variant. The nation's top infectious diseases expert tells CNN's State of the Union that we're going in the wrong direction, and he describes himself as very frustrated with rising infection rates. He says recommending that the vaccinated wear masks is under consideration by the government's leading public health officials. Fauci also suggests booster shots may be suggested for people with suppressed immune systems who have been vaccinated. France's parliament has approved the law requiring special virus passes for all restaurants and mandating vaccinations for all health workers. Both measures have prompted protests and political tensions. President Emmanuel Macron and his government say they are needed to protect vulnerable populations and hospitals as infections rebound and to avoid new lockdowns. The law adopted early Monday requires all workers in the healthcare sector to start getting vaccinated by September 15th or risk suspension. It also requires a health pass to enter all restaurants, trains, planes, and some other public venues. To get the pass, people must have proof they are fully vaccinated, recently tested negative, or recently recovered from the virus. Armed kidnappers in Nigeria released 28 of the more than 120 students who were abducted at the beginning of July from the Bethel Baptist High School in the northern town of Dimishi. The Reverend Israel Akanji said that more than 80 other children are still being held by the gunmen. So far, 34 children kidnapped on July 5th have been either released or have escaped from the custody. This is VOA News. Crowds of people flooded Tunis on Sunday to celebrate the news that Tunisia's president dismissed the government and froze parliament in a move that dramatically escalated a political crisis. But his opponents are calling this a coup. President Kais Saied said that he would assume executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister, and the biggest challenge yet to the democratic system Tunisia introduced in a 2011 revolution. Crowds numbering in tens of thousands stayed on the streets there and other cities, with some people setting off fireworks for hours after the announcement as helicopters circled overhead. However, the extent of support for Saied's move against a fragile government and divided parliament was not clear, and he warned against any violent response. An estimated 17 million people in the United States watched the opening ceremony for the Tokyo Olympics held in a largely empty stadium, down 36% from the kickoff to the Rio de Janeiro Games 5 years ago. The 17 million includes people who watched the ceremony live on NBC or online when it aired Friday morning, and those who saw an edited version on NBC in prime time that night. That's according to the Nielsen Company on Sunday. NBC was unable to break down how many people watched live and how many saw the primetime version. The 26.7 million who saw the Rio opening ceremony included both television and online viewership. Robert Paris Moses, a civil rights activist who endured beatings in jail while leading black voter registration in the U.S. and the American South during the 1960s and later helped improve minority education in math, has died. He was 86. Moses worked to dismantle segregation as the Mississippi field director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the Civil Rights Movement and was central to the 1964 Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of students went to the South to register for votes. Again, recapping our top story, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the United States' top infectious disease expert, says the United States is in an unnecessary predicament of soaring COVID-19 cases fueled by unvaccinated Americans and the Delta variant. The nation's top infectious disease expert tells CNN's State of the Union that we're going in the wrong direction. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bhatti in Washington. Today is Monday, July 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somalia's long-delayed electoral process stumbled again on Sunday.
There are some issues that need to be resolved. One of them is agreeing on Somaliland Electoral Committee. Another issue is the international community and the donors have not agreed on the financial support proposal that the government asked.
South Sudan's president names first female speaker of the National Assembly. Zimbabwe receives COVID-19 vaccines from China amid fears of a third wave. And Boko Haram attacks a village in Cameroon on the border with Nigeria.
Cameroon's military says on Saturday about 90 heavily armed terrorists on 6 military tactical vehicles and several motorcycles entered the country from Nigeria and launched attacks on Sangne village.
And the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra is suspected in federal court today, Monday. Those stories for Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somalia's long-delayed electoral process failed again to begin on Sunday as scheduled. Sunday should have been the Senate election, followed later in October this year by presidential election. Abdi Omar Mohamed Razak is a Somali member of parliament and a former security minister. He says some issues that needed to be resolved were not, including agreeing on Somaliland electoral committees and financing. He says the international community and donors have not agreed on the estimated $25 million price tag that the Somali government proposed to finance the election.
The election of the upper house that was supposed to take place today is yet again delayed. And I think despite the fact that the prime minister is genuinely committed to a timely election and has put efforts to resolve outstanding issues, the office of the presidency intends to use every delaying trick in the book. However, having said that, though, there are some issues that remain unresolved, and I think that's where the delay comes from. There are some issues that need to be resolved. One of them is agreeing on Somaliland Electoral Committee. Another issue is the financing. The international community and the donors have not agreed on the financial support proposal that the government asked, which is roughly $25 million. And there are some other technical issues that need to be ironed out before the election takes place, including the monitoring of the elections, including the security of the election polls, and so on and so forth. So unless these issues are resolved, the upper house elections will be delayed again.
So what does this mean now for the presidential election and the tenure of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo?
The delaying trend that we have seen for the last three times continues. I think it will be delayed again, the election of the presidency. It will not happen. Initially, it was supposed to happen in October 10. That has been shifted in the last timetable that the prime minister presented. So the likelihood that the presidential election should take place sometime in November be shifted again because the election of the upper house has not taken place as planned.
Does this delay affect all states in Somalia? In other words, when do you think Somalia can have election again?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer because so far twice has been postponed. And now it didn't happen as planned. Today was the day that the election of the upper house was supposed to take place. It didn't. So it's very difficult to answer that question. No one has a definitive answer to that question.
We thank you so much, as usual, for your insight.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Abdi Razak Omar Mohamed is a Somali member of parliament and former security minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. Cameroon says hundreds of civilians have fled a northern village on the border with Nigeria after a Boko Haram attack on Saturday that left 8 government troops dead and 13 wounded. The Cameroon military deployed to the area and said fighters were also killed. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's military says on Saturday about 90 heavily armed terrorists on 6 military tactical vehicles and several motorcycles entered the country from Nigeria and launched attacks on Sangné village. Sangné is located in Cameroon's far north region that shares a border with Nigeria's Borno state, said to be an epicenter of jihadist group Boko Haram. In a press release, a military spokesperson says the fighters killed 8 Cameroonian troops and wounded 13 others. The statement by Army Captain Cyril Serge Atonfa Gemo says the troops fought back but did not say how many combatants were killed. Gemo said the fighters escaped to Nigeria carrying bodies of their dead peers. Miji Yawa Bakari is governor of Cameroon's far north region. Bakari says 6 of the Cameroonian troops were killed on the spot, while the other 2 died while being transported to a hospital in the northern town of Marwa. He says many troops suffered severe wounds during the intense shootout with Boko Haram terrorists, but managed to escape. Bakari says he is extending the condolences of Cameroon's President Paul Biya to the families of the soldiers killed. Cameroon's military said Biya immediately ordered the deployment of more troops to secure the country's territory and civilians. Bakari says several hundred civilians escaped from Sangné and neighboring villages to the bush for safety. He says the fleeing civilians should return to their villages as the military has been redeployed to protect lives and property.
Boko Haram n'est pas fini.
He says people who think that Boko Haram has been eradicated from northern Cameroon are wrong. He says he is calling on civilians to help the military fight the terrorists through information sharing. Bakari says he has asked traditional rulers, the clergy and community leaders to remobilize self-defense groups, especially along the border with Nigeria. The Nigerian government has not issued a statement regarding the attack, but the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, comprising troops from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad and Benin, has acknowledged the incident and said the fighters crossed over from Nigeria. Security analyst and former military spokesman DJ Bajik says the Cameroonian military alone cannot defeat Boko Haram terrorists. He says Boko Haram has been infiltrating many localities on the northern border with Nigeria. He says it is very difficult for the military to detect the terrorists if civilians do not collaborate by reporting strangers in all border towns and villages. Bajek says churches and mosques should ask civilians to stop lodging visitors and giving strangers food, thinking that they are obeying religious teachings. Bajek said fighters may be disguising themselves as ranchers moving around in search of food for their cattle or as farmers visiting markets to sell crops. In December 2020, Bakari said Boko Haram was establishing ties with top officials of his region. The revelation came after Cameroon's military arrested Blama Mala, a former lawmaker, for allegedly supplying cattle to the Nigerian terrorist group. Mala was detained in the northern town of Mora. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for 11 years to create an Islamic caliphate in northeast Nigeria. The fighting has spread to Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin, with regular killings, burnings of mosques, churches, markets, and schools, and attacks on military installations. The United Nations reports that Boko Haram violence has cost the lives of 30,000 people and displaced about 2 million in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says the country made history last Friday when President Kiir nominated the first female speaker of the country's transitional National Legislative Assembly. Atain Wekatain says the nomination of Jema Nunu Kumba as Speaker of Parliament means that a woman is heading one of the three pillars of the South Sudan government.
First of all, history has been made by appointing the first ever woman to be the Speaker of the Parliament in the Republic of South Sudan. The nomination of Comrade Nunu Kumba came as a result of consultation that the President with the Political Bureau as well as the caucus of the SPLM in the designated revitalized transitional national parliament. She was the acting Secretary General of the Sudan People Liberation Movement for over 10 years, so she's the right person.
For so long, activists have been demanding more roles for women in the national leadership of South Sudan. Can we say that this nomination is overdue?
Yes, given that this position, the second position in the government, has been given to a woman because the executive is led by the president and the legislature led by a woman and the judiciary led by a man, now the three pillars of the government has been filled with 35% representation of women being properly implemented, because the other pillar is the legislature is now led by a woman, and another woman is a deputy, by the way, deputy of the Council of State, Mary Ayan Majok. So women are now represented, and I think they can be quite happy. Now I've seen several women organizations within South Sudan are celebrating the nomination of Comrade Jema Nunu Kumba.
Help us to understand, why should President Salva Kiir nominate the Speaker of Parliament? Normally, at least in other countries, the Speaker is elected by his or her peers in Parliament.
The government we are in is what is called a revitalized national unity government, whereby it is a government of parties that were fighting the war before and signed the peace agreement on the 12th of September 2018. So all the positions are allocated to the parties in the government who are the former fighters. So the speaker positions have been given to the Sudan People Liberation Movement, which is led by President Salva Kiir, and they have more than 350 members. So the position is for the SPLM. That is why the president can nominate someone for the 350 members to endorse. So it is the SPLM seat that made the president to nominate the person. The Speaker of Council of State is not nominated by the president because it is given to the SPLM-IO. It is the SPLM-IO that will decide who should be the Speaker of the Council of State. So when Dr. Riak nominate the Speaker of Council of State, the president's role will be actually to appoint. This is what the revitalized peace agreement says.
The newly appointed members of parliament, when are they expected to be sworn in?
They will be sworn in within this coming week, which has started today, Monday, within the course of that week, before the weekend.
Thank you so much. We do always appreciate speaking with you.
Thank you.
Atain Wekatain is the spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 26th. Zimbabwe on Sunday received 1 million Sinovac vaccines from China as the African country battles to meet the demand for the COVID-19 jabs. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA News, Zimbabweans want to get vaccinated to beat a third wave facing the country.
After the arrival of the doses from China on Sunday, Finance Minister Muthuli Ncube told reporters that Zimbabwe had paid $92 million for 12 million jabs from China and from the COVAX, the United Nations Vaccine Sharing Initiative.
So our vaccination program and the vaccine acquisition program is going very well. For the first dose, already reaching about 50,000 vaccinations a day, which is good going indeed. So all is going well, and we feel that we're well on our way towards achieving that target of herd immunity, which we need in order to open the economy safely so that the recovery is sustained and we can move from strength to strength in line with our objective.
In a virtual press conference this week, Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, said the continent was going through a third wave of COVID-19 infections and should urgently ramp up COVID-19 vaccination program.
Africa continues to lag behind, sadly. Yet Africa's supply crunch is starting to ease. The first delivery of doses donated by the United States government through the COVAX facility are arriving in Africa, and altogether nearly 60 million doses are expected in the coming weeks through COVAX from Team Europe, UK, purchased doses, and from other partners. African countries must go all out and speed up their vaccine rollouts by 5 to 6 times if they are to get all these doses into arms and fully vaccinate the most vulnerable 10% of their people by the end of September.
COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Slightly more than 1,400,000 Zimbabweans out of a population of 14 million have received their first shot, and nearly 680,000 have received their second inoculation since the program started in February. Nomeni Murwizi is one of the Zimbabweans who has yet to get a vaccine due to shortages.
My assumption would be the chances of me getting vaccinated would actually would have increased due to the increased supply of the vaccines. My guess or wish would be the service rate would actually have actually improved so that the numbers could plummet and the chances of people getting vaccinated does increase. So the expectation actually increases of me getting a vaccine with no hassle at all, or with minimum fuss.
Zimbabwe turned down Johnson & Johnson vaccines, which the African Union sourced for its members with financing from the African Development Bank, but changed its mind. Zimbabwe has 97,277 confirmed corona infections and 3,050 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global outbreak. On Sunday, John Mangwiro, Zimbabwe's junior health minister, said with the arrival of 1 million jabs, the vaccination program would intensify. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
In Nigeria, the lawyer for the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra says he will file an application today, Monday, for Nnamdi Kanu's release or for him to be transferred to a correctional center where he can be examined by medical experts. Kanu's trial is expected to begin today, Monday, in a federal court in Abuja. He is charged with terrorism and treasonable felony, among other charges. Kanu's organization is calling for an independent state for ethnic Igbos in southeast Nigeria. The Nigerian government considers the group a terrorist organization. Lawyer Efiyanyi Ejiofor says the federal government has no right to stop their friends who plan to come to the courthouse today to witness the trial.
Actually, we intend to file an application for his release against the backdrop of the fact that he never jumped bail, and the facts of what transpired in his home will be presented to the courts, probably in the subsequent proceedings, not tomorrow. Tomorrow he may be, we have other applications before the courts will take tomorrow. The one that deal with is our request to transfer him to correctional center for attention and also for medical experts to see him and then look at his medical concerns and possible medical solutions to his medical situation.
The last time we spoke, you mentioned Kano's health. What is the status of his health now?
It has not improved tremendously, but he's still managing because somebody who is kept in a solitary confinement is not allowed to have deserving medical solutions to his case, as he would have already been obliged in a normal set of cost of living. So he's not improving, but we are going to address it in court tomorrow because it contains an application we file in court, which is right for hearing. So tomorrow we mention it to the court and also take our application and allow the court to rule on it for his sound medical expert to visit him and give him medical attention.
We understand that Biafrans plan to show up in numbers at the court, even though the federal government has warned them not to come to the court.
Thank you, Mr. James. The federal government has no right to stop people from participating in the court proceedings. It's their constitutional right to be there. So what we'll be talking about is their conduct within the court's vicinity. I've already tweeted and urged people who are coming, sympathizers and well-wishers who are coming to be part of the proceedings, to be civil in their conduct and also not to be armed with any form of IPV insignias, because that will amount to automatic killing. Because once a security agent sights you with any form of IPV insignia, the person will be eliminated almost immediately. So they are coming, and I will urge his friend and also urge them to be peaceful and civil in their conduct and assemble, sing, display their placards about the injustice being meted out to Nnamdi Kanu and also the entire Igbos and Biafrans.
When we last spoke, you mentioned that Kanu was arrested in Kenya. I'm wondering, what was he doing in Kenya?
As a British citizen, he has the right to visit any place he wants to go to. He actually was in Kenya for a private engagement, so and private meetings and other engagement that has to do with his struggle.
Is there dissension or disagreement within the indigenous people of Biafra movement since Kanu's arrest?
No, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think they have any issues. As my client, but if they have any issue that has to do with the areas of my intervention as their lawyer, they will let me know.
FEIE AGO4 is the lawyer for Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Thompson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Thompson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with action and the latest update from the Tokyo Olympic Games as day 4 of the 32nd Games rolled in on Sunday for athletes to claim silverware, many hoping that it will be in the form of Olympic gold. In swimming, South Africa's swimming star Tatjana Shoemaker has set a new Olympic record in posting the fastest time and the heat for the women's 100 meters breaststroke. Tatjana Shoemaker, who is considered the favorite for the Olympic gold in the 200 meters breaststroke, stomped to victory in heat 5, touching the wall in 1 minute 4.82 seconds. Staying with swimming, teenage swimmer Ahmed Hafuani stunned the Tokyo Aquatic Center to become the first African to win a gold medal at the 2020 Olympics after a shock triumph in the 400 meters freestyle. His winning time of 3 minutes 43.36 seconds was 3 seconds faster than his personal best. And now to Olympic football news. Reigning champions Brazil were held to a goalless draw by the Ivory Coast in the men's Olympic football competition on Sunday, while in another game involving another African side, the South African under-23 Tokyo Olympics football dream ended on Sunday with a heartbreaking 4-3 defeat to France at the Satiana Stadium on Sunday, where André Preé's hat-trick proved too good to earn France a 4-3 win over South Africa to keep the French hopes of progressing into the next round alive. Staying with Olympic football news, Zambia international Barbara Banda continued her superb breathtaking goal-scoring form in Tokyo 2020 as she becomes the first woman in Olympic history to back 2 hat-tricks. The 21-year-old forward had emerged the first Zambian and African to score a hat-trick at the Games following a treble in her side's 10-3 humiliation against the Netherlands on Wednesday. The Shanghai Shenghai striker replicated same efforts against China, but they were lately forced to a 4-4 draw on Saturday. In basketball news, Nigeria's men's basketball team, the Tigers, were beaten 84-67 in their opening basketball game in Group B against the Bombers of Australia. Day 4 of the Olympic Games will see South Africa's Rugby Sevens team a strong favorite for the gold medal. The expectation is a little lower, but the boys will be hoping to go at least one better and make the final, if not go all the way to getting their hands on an Olympic gold medal. The speed, power and excitement of the Kenya rugby team makes them a threat to anyone on their day, and they will be looking to pull off a shock or two and get into the knockout stages, which could be an improved showing from their last Olympic outing. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty, wishing that you will have a great week.
Today is Monday, the 26th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. More than 100 are dead and another 100 are missing after landslides in India.
Authorities have said over 130,000 people were rescued from nearly 900 affected villages across Maharashtra state.
Plus, the World Health Organization offers up solutions as it marks the first World Drowning Prevention Day.
Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports 2.5 million people have died in drowning incidents.
We'll have these stories and more next. More than 100 people have died and another 100 are missing after days of heavy monsoon rains triggered landslides and flooding in western India. Karen Chamas from the Associated Press starts us off.
Authorities have said over 130,000 people were rescued from nearly 900 affected villages across Maharashtra state. Many were stranded on rooftops or atop buses on highways. India's Navy also said it deployed helicopters to evacuate stranded people and sent rescue teams with boats to the region. One of the worst hit villages was in Talai, south of Mumbai, the capital of Maharashtra state. The village of 59 households was buried by a massive landslide as bodies continued to be recovered, bringing the death toll to over 40 in Talai alone. Disasters caused by landslides and flooding are common in India during the June-September monsoon season. I'm Karen Chamas.
The town of Dinal, Belgium has been cleaning up on Sunday after the heaviest flood in decades Saturday turned the streets into torrential streams that washed away cars and pavement, but hasn't resulted in any reported fatalities. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi is up next.
Authorities predict the cost of the damage will be significant. Local resident Pierre Collot describes a deluge.
In less than 20 minutes, the water gushed down from here above. Then it gradually grew larger. It became a torrent which took all the cars away gradually, and everything was piled up there in the back. Then it went into the garages. So everything has to be rebuilt.
The flash floods followed a two-hour thunderstorm, which left streets strewn with rubble, wrecked cars, and thick mud. Dinan was spared the deadly floods 10 days ago that killed 37 people in southeast Belgium and many more in Germany. But the violence of Saturday's storm surprised many.
Maha Albadrawi of Reuters News. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top U.S. infectious disease expert, sounded new alarms on Sunday about the surge in coronavirus cases in the country. In the United States, hospitalizations and deaths are far below their peaks last winter, but the number of new infections has been rising sharply in parts of the country where skepticism about the need to get vaccinated, the safety of vaccines, and resistance to government suggestions to get inoculated remain a potent force. As it stands, the government says more than 162 Americans have been fully vaccinated, which corresponds to 49% of the country's population and nearly 60% of adults. But polls have shown that as many as 80% of unvaccinated Americans say that they will definitely not get inoculated or are unlikely to, no matter how many officials urge them to get the shots. Some cities, including Los Angeles in the west, St. Louis in the middle of the country, and in the state of Texas, the city of Austin have also imposed new orders for people to wear masks in public indoor spaces regardless of vaccination status. Other cities around the country are also considering similar directives. Elsewhere, Malaysian health authorities announced over 17,000 new infections to bring their total overall coronavirus infections to more than 1 million. And South Korea said on Sunday it was going to tighten physical distancing rules as it continues battling rising infections. The new rules will include a 10 p.m. dining curfew and a ban on gatherings of more than four people. The new measures take effect on Tuesday and are slated to last for 2 weeks. In Japan, which is, of course, holding the 2020 Olympic Games, the Kyoto News Agency reports that Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga met with Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike to discuss anti-coronavirus measures. Olympic organizers on Sunday also reported 10 new COVID-19 cases involving two athletes, six Olympic personnel, and one member of the media, as well as one contractor. That raises the total number connected to the Games to 132. In Africa, hundreds of protesters rallied in the Tunisian capital and other cities on Sunday. During the evening hours, witnesses told Reuters News that military vehicles had surrounded the parliament building, hours after President Kais Saied said that the body had been frozen for a month and dismissed the government. The ruling party called it a coup, writing on Facebook, quote, "What Kais Saied is doing is a state coup against the revolution and against the constitution." Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has more.
Police and protesters clashed in cities across Tunisia on Sunday as demonstrators demanded the government step down. A spike in infections has aggravated economic troubles and exposed the failings of a squabbling political class. The protests, the biggest in Tunisia for months, were called by social media activists. No political parties publicly backed the rallies. In Tunis, police used pepper spray against protesters, who threw stones and shouted slogans demanding that Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi quit and Parliament be dissolved. The pandemic has hammered the economy, which was already struggling in the aftermath of the 2011 revolution that ousted longtime authoritarian leader Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. As a young man in 2011, this man says, "I called for jobs, freedom, and national dignity." 10 years on, he says he's still calling for the same things. Public support for democracy has waned amid surging unemployment and crumbling state services.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. On Saturday, some 160,000 people came out into the streets protesting against measures the French government are looking to put in place to safeguard the spread of COVID-19. French President Emmanuel Macron called for national unity as he stepped up efforts to get people fully vaccinated. Joining us from Paris is Catherine Field to explain exactly what went down on Saturday and why.
I think, to be honest, the first thing you've got to look at is the numbers. Let's do the math here. 160,000 protesters across France went out onto the street on one Saturday to protest this new measure put in place by President Macron, which would impose proof of a double vaccination or a negative test on people who want to visit public venues. So that would be a cinema, nightclub, bars, and restaurants. Look at the other number. In the first week after Emmanuel Macron put that idea out there for Parliament to debate, 6 million French people signed up to have the jab. Since then, there have been some days where it's been a bit lower, but there's been between 500,000 and 700,000, sometimes 800,000 jabs a day since Macron's speech. So you have to bear in mind that the support within the population for this vaccination push is very strong. It's around 67%. It is just that this particular group that opposes it is so vocal, and that they seem to have garnered a lot of support from young people, people aged between 16 and 24, some a bit older, who are coming out here saying it's just not fair. Now, what the government is saying back at that is, you're not excluded. You don't have to have the vaccine. You just cannot go to public places where other people who have been vaccinated and share space with them. That's all they're saying. To back this up, the government is still saying, you've got these big campaigns on the radio and on TV saying, please go and get vaccinated. It's the only way you're going to get your old life back. So it's a bit of a mixed picture, because the people who are protesting against these measures are just so vocal, and they really are getting the attention of the media. On top of that, there are also small groups that are going along and are peeling off from the main demonstration, what is quite often peaceful demonstrations, and fighting it out with police, which is where we saw on the main streets in Paris, around the Arc de Triomphe. We saw police firing tear gas, using water cannons. to clear the crowds who had just really come away from that main demonstration.
Yeah, it really sounds as if France is really moving forward with its vaccination program. Information that I have says that originally the French government was hoping to vaccinate some 40 million people by the end of August, but the health department says they could reach that target as early as the close of business on Monday, the 26th of July, and are refocusing their efforts to hit the 50 million mark by the end of August. And with a country only with the size of 67 million in terms of total population, that's an incredibly high mark in terms of the percentage of people with a full vaccination. Going back to these measures that the government is looking to impose, what exactly does it prevent people from doing if they aren't fully vaccinated?
Well, it depends very much on where they work. If you're working in a healthcare facility, whether it be as a nurse, a doctor, a nurse's aide, or even an administration official, if by the middle of September you haven't had that double vaccination, then you will not be able to work in that facility. You cannot be fired, but you will not be able to work, and you will not be paid, so you won't be able to do that. Already, some of the measures, the first batch of these measures that came in on the 15th of July means that if you're not double vaccinated, you can't go to the cinema, you can't go to the swimming pool, you can't go to some museum. Come the 1st of August, then that's going to get really difficult. Then that is when they bring in restaurants, bars, nightclubs, those sorts of very public places. And again, the message is, it's not that you are being excluded, it's just life's going to be a little bit more difficult. And when you look at some of the laws that are going through associated with this, the government has tried very hard to make sure that these people are not excluded from places they really have to go. So these health measures cannot be imposed at a supermarket, for example. They'll still be able to go to the supermarket, still be able to do their shopping. They will not be impinged on that. So essentially, the government is saying, okay, fine, you make that decision, but you cannot be part of the group that have decided to contribute to society in that way.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The commander of Iraq's self-styled pro-Iranian resistance forces has threatened to mount more attacks on U.S. troops inside the country if they don't withdraw. The threat comes hours after Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken detailed the close cooperation between the two countries. A recent drone attack against U.S. forces in Kurdistan left no casualties. Edward Uranian is up next.
A U.S. coalition spokesman in Iraq confirmed in a statement Saturday that a drone attack overnight on U.S. forces at the Kiara base in Iraqi Kurdistan caused no casualties. The attack came on the heels of a declaration by pro-Iranian militia commander Faisal Khazali, who threatened to mount further attacks on U.S. forces inside Iraq until they withdraw from the country. He says that military operations against U.S. forces in Iraq will not cease until they withdraw from the country, and opposition forces will respond if the U.S. administration doesn't understand that and will retaliate if the U.S. attacks them. Arab media reported that Iran's intelligence chief visited the Iraqi capital several times during the past 10 days. VOA could not independently confirm the report. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein told journalists during a press conference with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken Friday during a visit to Washington that his country needs the U.S.-backed coalition to fight terrorism. He says that Iraq needs the international coalition in many ways and is working with it under the leadership of the U.S. against Islamic State terrorists, and we need to share information between Iraq and the coalition and the U.S. to continue to fight those terrorists. Iraqi media reported that the country's national security advisor, Qasem al-Araji, told journalists on the sidelines of the meeting, however, that Baghdad does not need U.S. forces in the country any longer. Secretary of State Blinken told journalists at the meeting with Hussein Friday that both the U.S. and Iraq need each other.
We're, of course, the closest of partners fight against ISIS, and we can take tremendous pride in the work we've done together to defeat ISIS, to make sure that it stays defeated. But I think the partnership between the United States and Iraq is much broader and needs to be even a common fight against ISIS.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi is scheduled to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House Monday to announce a number of agreements between the U.S. and Iraq. Arab media reported that the U.S. is planning to give $155 million in aid to Baghdad, in addition to a number of projects involving archaeology, education, and the battle against COVID-19. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that statements like the one by pro-Iranian Shiite leader Qais al-Ghazali is mostly a declaration of victory, which mirrors triumphal calls from the Taliban in Afghanistan following the U.S. withdrawal there.
Each extremist group wants to claim a win from the U.S. leaving, and then they puff their chests out in a show of, quote, masculinity. What they don't mention is how they themselves have added to the suffering of their own people. Real leaders take care of their people.
Iraqi analyst Najm Khosab told State TV that he anticipates a period of calm after the series of agreements expected to be signed by Prime Minister Kazemi and President Biden on Monday. He says that the Biden administration differs from its predecessor in that it doesn't want to remain inside Iraqi cities, but just to hold two air bases, Ain al-Assad in Anbar province and Kiara in Kurdistan. He argues that that indicates a de-escalation is coming in the near future. Much of the political rhetoric in Iraqi politics at the moment appears to be aimed at the upcoming parliamentary elections in October. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Alaska is the northernmost part of the United States, and it is big. Big in landmass and big in military power. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb crisscrossed Alaska by helicopter Saturday with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin to learn more about the last frontier state's strategic importance.
There's a lot of wild, open space for military installations in Alaska. Grizzly bears prowl nearby. And the weather is wild, too. In the winters, it can get down to around minus 45 degrees Celsius. So why would the U.S. place so many of its troops and defenses in such a harsh environment? The answer, according to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, is geography.
We are an Indo-Pacific nation, and we are an Arctic nation. And here in Alaska, those two critical regions intersect.
Alaska is bordered by the Pacific Ocean and the Arctic Ocean. Eielson Air Force Base, in the heart of Alaska, is about 160 kilometers from the Arctic Circle. There, Austin says, the U.S. has beefed up defenses and expanded training in an effort to increase its competitive edge over near-peer adversaries, Russia and China.
You've seen us increase our capability up here recently with the arrival of additional F-35s, and we're in the process of building out the capabilities to support that effort.
Which is especially useful since fifth-generation F-35 fighter jets based at Alsen can reach anywhere in the northern hemisphere. Fly over the North Pacific, you're in Asia. Want to get to Europe? Just hop across the Arctic. Need to practice military skills at home? There's a 200,000 square kilometer training range here.
Unless you've served here, people don't fully understand how strategically important our state is.
Alaskan Senator Dan Sullivan is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He says the Pentagon is right to focus on high-end competitors. But he's worried the U.S. may not be keeping up.
China's been increasing its defense spending by 10% a year. Right, and they're going to keep doing that. We, you know, second term of the Obama administration cut defense spending by 25%. Trump, we got back on it. It's going down again. So, absolutely I'm concerned, and so are most members of the Armed Services Committee. Doesn't matter what party.
Sullivan says he wants to see a defense budget that grows 3 to 5% annually to keep pace with Chinese military investments. And he points to bases spread across America's last frontier states as a testament to how defense dollars can go a long way from Washington. Carla Babb, VOA News, Eielson Air Force Base, Alaska.
Shanghai and its neighboring coastal regions in China canceled flights, slowed or suspended subway trains, and closed businesses as Typhoon Infa made landfall on Sunday. The storm landed in Zhaozhou, a major port. Infa flooded 6 kilometers of roads and felled some 1,000 trees. The typhoon came as the country was still coping with massive floods that killed at least 63 people and forced the evacuation of more than 1 million. The World Food Program is renewing its appeal for unimpeded access to Ethiopia's northern province of Tigray, where an estimated 4 million people are suffering from acute hunger. WFP says that the UN Humanitarian Air Service has transported 30 aid workers and urgently needed relief supplies for distribution across Tigray into Mekele, the provincial capital. The WFP hopes to reach an additional 80,000 people in the northwest in the coming days. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is condemning the violent suppression by Iranian security forces of protesters demanding action to resolve chronic water shortages in Kurdistan province. It's a province of 5 million inhabitants and used to be the country's main and most reliable source of water. At least 4 people, including 1 minor, reportedly have been killed. Gaza was hit by Israeli airstrikes Sunday after incendiary balloons launched from the Palestinian enclave caused fires in the Jewish state. No injuries were reported on either side. Sources told AFP that the Israeli strikes targeted an open area in northern Gaza and a militant training site belonging to Hamas. Israel's army had no immediate comment on the strikes.
Studies published in the journal Science provide fresh details regarding the 3 distinct layers of Mars, its crust, mantle, and core. NASA says data from its InSight Lander's seismic experiment for interior structure instrument showed that the crust is thinner than expected, may be composed of 2 or 3 sublayers, and measures about 20 kilometers if there are 2 sublayers, and 37 kilometers if the crust has 3 sublayers. Next is the red planet's mantle, and the new findings suggest it reaches 1,560 kilometers below the surface. Finally, there's the molten core of Mars, which was found to have a radius of 1,830 kilometers. Scientists are still unsure if the core is made up of just molten material or if it's like Earth's, which has molten material surrounding a solid core. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. July 25th was the first World Drowning Prevention Day. On it, the World Health Organization offered life-saving solutions to prevent most of the 236,000 estimated deaths from drowning every year. The United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution in April establishing this international day to raise awareness of drowning as a serious problem. Lisa Schlein has more.
Summertime has been celebrated in song as the season when the living is easy. On a less celebratory note, summertime in the Northern Hemisphere also is the peak season for deaths by drowning. Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports 2.5 million people have died in drowning incidents. It says more than half of all drowning deaths are among people under age 30, with the highest rates among children under the age of 5. David Meddings, a WHO medical officer, says drowning is the second leading cause of death among children and youth under age 19 in wealthy countries such as the United States, Switzerland, and France. He notes, though, drowning disproportionately affects the poor and the marginalized.
The rates for drowning in low and middle income countries are 3 times higher than the rates we observe in high income countries. And so it's really the populations with the least resources to be able to adapt to the threats around them that are at highest risk for drowning. The Western Pacific region has the world's highest drowning rates, followed by the African region.
WHO reports more than 90% of drowning deaths occur in rivers, lakes, wells, irrigation canals, and even domestic water storage vessels in the poorer countries. It says children and adolescents in rural areas are disproportionately affected. Medding says national surveys in Africa show most drownings occur among young adult men out on fishing vessels.
For example, there was a study done in Tanzania among lakeside communities that showed that the risk of death from drowning exceeded the risk of death in that population for death from HIV, TB, or malaria. So 80% of deaths occurring in young adult men who are, in a sense, obligated to go out on fishing vessels that often are inherently unsafe watercraft without advanced weather warning and without knowing how to swim.
The report does not include statistics on flood-related mortality, deaths due to water transport mishaps such as capsized ferry boats, or migrant deaths that occur while crossing the perilous Mediterranean Sea. WHO recommends a number of cost-effective, life-saving measures. It says children should be taught basic swimming and water safety skills. Wells and potentially dangerous water areas should be fenced off, and bystanders should be trained in safe rescue and resuscitation. It says safe boating and ferry regulations should be enforced and calls for flood risk management to be improved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scores of wildfires raging across the western United States is kicking up so much smoke it's helping an army of firefighters gain ground. Reuters reporter Jason Albano explains.
Scores of wildfires continued to burn through the western United States over the weekend. Video obtained by Reuters showed the Tamarack Fire ripping through a forest in Nevada on Saturday after it spilled over from California. Local authorities say about 4% of it has been contained. The National Weather Service posted red flag warnings in parts of Oregon, Montana, and Idaho as fires raged across the three states. The fires have generated so much smoke that it turned the full moon orange on Friday evening, which could be seen as far as Washington, D.C., after winds carried the smoke eastward. Officials over the weekend said that the amount of smoke being created has actually helped ground crews of more than 2,000 people battle the so-called bootleg fire in Portland, Oregon. It's the largest by far of more than 80 active wildfires burning in 13 states. Officials said that a smoke shade from California's fires is blocking sunlight, which in turn is creating cooler, more stable surface conditions in Oregon. The bootleg fire has so far burned through more than 400,000 acres of brush and timber, over half the size of Rhode Island. It's now the state's third largest wildfire on record since 1900. While the fire spread has slowed in recent days, officials also reported that ground crews are battling an outbreak of COVID-19, with at least 9 firefighters quarantined so far.
Jason Albano from Reuters News. Experts have said that rare footage of an endangered marsupial in the Australian outback is a sign that native animals are beginning to recover from years of feral cat predation. Phil Mercer rounds us out.
Feral cats threaten the survival of over 100 native species in Australia, according to federal environment officials. The opportunistic predators have caused the extinction of some ground-dwelling birds and small to medium-sized mammals. Experts have said they've been a major cause of decline for many endangered marsupials, including the bilby, bandicoot, bettong, and numbat. In the northern state of Queensland, though, there are signs that some native animals are beginning to recover. At the Astrabla Downs National Park, 3,000 feral cats have been removed since 2013. Licensed hunters have said that thermal imaging technology, rather than powerful spotlights, have helped them control the wild cat population by making it easier to find them hiding in vegetation. A recent survey in the region revealed a record number of 471 bilbies, one of Australia's best-known marsupials. Also, for the first time in a decade, researchers managed to film a threatened desert marsupial in outback Queensland in June. Ecologists say that decent rainfall has also helped to boost marsupial numbers. Nearly 3 billion animals in Australia were killed or displaced by the devastating Black Summer bushfires in 2019 and 2020, according to scientists. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. Just visit voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.